Case number 20-3574, 23576, 23643. Melissa Yatsko et al. Versus Dean Grazioli et al. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes for plaintiffs, 15 minutes to be shared by defendants. Mr. Linehan for the appellant cross appellee, when ready.
Am I wrong, or do they also have an exception? relates to the threat of physical harm that was being pounded on Sergeant Grazioli that he was responding to. So you can't have excessive force if Grazioli is backing up, he's being confronted several times, punched, backing up several times.
Go ahead. Those are issues of fact, are they not?
No, I think all of those issues are agreed upon. There's no dispute as that. We have the video.
No, because your client says, I read both depositions, your client says, I didn't punch him, I didn't shove him, and I can't remember the shooting. And the bystander says they were fighting, and your client was punching just as much as his client was.
Ian Fitzpatrick is one of the depositions, one of the statements that was provided, who saw the entire fight, and he said that the officer was putting his hand up.
Okay,
so Chambers is...
And the woman says, I can't remember her name, Steele, says they were punching. He was punching. So why, back to Judge Griffin's question, how do we decide that?
Again, you have a person that is attacking a police officer with his gun drawn in a dominant hand, and he's putting his arms up to deflect the punches. Whether that's a punch or deflecting the punches, regardless, he's constantly attacking at him. And the question is, he's getting hit. Is that a threat of physical harm sufficient enough to discharge a weapon?
So can I ask you, how are you narrowing it? Are you looking at it at the moment he gets spit on, he says, you're gonna have to kill me, and then he punches him in the face apparently. That's the time we should analyze and determine.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I am. And again, because if it's your job to determine how broad or narrow to determine that time. And the case law says you got to do it pretty much right up until the point of where this thing was happening, not a greater period of time. But as it gets back to some factors,
what are the circumstances here that allow you to shoot somebody? If you're an officer, we're assuming he's an officer at this stage of your argument.
The circumstances are a person that is constantly lunging at the officer, punching the officer in the face, spitting, saying you're going to have to kill me to stop me. Those are all facts that are uncontroverted.
That's enough to shoot.
Yes. Yeah. When you see the amount of punches, because at some point, if he doesn't stop, he's going to take your gun, knock you out, or do something.
Say the last part again.
If you don't do that, you're going to get a situation where he can continue to punch you, knock you out, take your gun, and shoot you, or do something of more physical harm to you. But that physical harm of attacking your face, cutting your lips, smashing you, is physical harm. It's serious enough that at that point, you can defend yourself. You don't have to take the
beat. You can defend yourself without shooting somebody, though. I mean, he's a big man, and the other guy's a small guy. You can back up and hit him back. I mean, I'm just asking, because this is what you're saying the law is.
Yeah.
You're saying when they're coming at you, you can shoot him because you have a gun in your hand. It sounds a little counterintuitive to me.
I would respectfully disagree from the standpoint of someone is constantly attacking you. I think you have the right to defend yourself, and you can use the lethal force. With the amount of harm that's being impacted upon you, certainly. I see that my time is up.
Any further questions at this time? I have a question about jurisdiction. I don't know when to raise it. Are you coming back up later? Or
yes, I will serve some time, yes.
Okay, well, I want to address the question of jurisdiction with respect to your appeal.
The interlocutory appeal?
with respect to plaintiff's appeal of the summary judgment
certainly
in your favor on the Monell claim?
Certainly, Your Honor.
In order to address that, we have to have jurisdiction over that claim, and that depends on the district court's certification. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And I'm wondering whether the district court properly certified it. Do you take a position on that?
I don't believe. I believe the district court entered final judgment under Rule 54. I believe it's B. Final judgment on that and certified it.
And was that proper? It seems to me you could make a strong argument that that's not proper. That's a different jurisdictional issue from the one you've been talking about now.
Right. We argued against that. We argued against the
certification.
The certification of the question up here for two reasons. One, you know, the course of review.
It's intertwined, right?
I'm sorry?
It's intertwined, right? It's not.
It is intertwined in the sense that you're dealing with the same operative facts, so to speak. However, the court's review of those facts is diametrically different. Under qualified immunity analysis, you have to assume a lot of the facts that plaintiffs have alleged, but under a de novo.
You argue that it wasn't proper to be certified under 54B?
I'm not arguing that at this
time.
Did
you below?
I'm sorry?
Did you argue that below?
We didn't argue that it was improper.
You don't take any position one way or the other.
No, we don't.
So you'd be perfectly happy if we said, I mean, as happy as not, if we just said there was no jurisdiction over that.
If you want to dismiss the appeal, we'd be more than happy to entertain
that. Okay, so then I have to ask the plaintiffs about that. Is that right?
Just to be Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so with respect to defending the grant of the Monell claim, essentially plaintiffs have offered one piece of unauthenticated evidence regarding the DOJ report. We argued in our summary judgment briefing that the court should strike it, should not consider it under various civil rules and discovery proceedings. The first time it was ever raised was...
okay, assuming we did consider it.
Okay, assuming we did consider
it,
we still feel...
Is it just too general and not specific to...
It's more than that, Your Honor. It's stale. It doesn't have anything to do with what was going on in 2018 in the City of Cleveland's Department of Policies regarding the excessive force claims regarding officers. As the court may or may not know, Department of Justice has been in there since 2014, and several, both district courts and the Sixth Circuit in House v. Hudis, said that that DOJ report standing alone is not enough to defeat or to support a Monell claim against the city on those claims. So we think that the district court got it correct in that it didn't consider that for numerous reasons. I mean, the factual circuit contains here saying, assuming you're going to hear it or review the report itself, putting aside the evidentiary issues regarding it, it doesn't have anything to do or comment whatsoever on what was going on in 2018. Obviously, there's been sweeping changes, and we believe it was plaintiff's burden to come forward with those or come forward with evidence that showed that what was going on in 2010 through 2013, which is the time period that the DOJ report supposedly covers, was still going on in 2018, some 5 to 10 or 8 years later. It's our opinion that it's too remote in time, and it doesn't even cover the same sort of situations with officers covering.
Was that their only evidence in support of their Monell claim?
Yes, Your Honor. As far as that prong of the Monell analysis with regards to customer tolerance.
All right. I think we understand your argument. You want to spend 30 seconds to wrap up?
The only thing that I would add is the other problem under the Monell claim is that they offered an expert report in order to try and establish some type of duty or responsibility for the City of Cleveland or any municipality for the police force to oversee and somehow supervise officers that are not employed by them, not working for them, are on their own and doing secondary employment. As the court correctly found, there was never even a case regulation or standard that was cited by plaintiffs in response to our motion for summary judgment on that issue that would establish such a responsibility. And that also puts aside the issue of the expert report itself not being proper Rule 56 evidence. It was not sworn, it was not a declaration in it. So we would ask that the court not consider it.
All right. Just 1 minute. Since I don't consider the city to be a proper appellate
tell me where your facts come from, because Ms. Steele says they were, I think it's Steele, right?
Breanne Steele was one of the witnesses?
Yeah, she says they were both fighting. I've watched the video, which you can only see so much from, but it looks like they're going back and forth. And then, right, is it, I mean, do you agree that right before he shot, he said, you're going to have to kill me, spit in his face, and punched him in the face?
We agree that, yes, we agree with those facts.
Okay, so taking that, what's your best case that shows it's clearly established at that point when those facts occur, a police officer can't shoot them? Because I agree, the rest of it's disputed. I don't agree that the cop wasn't fighting like that. That seems like a ridiculous assertion by the by Graziello. So what's, based on what I read and saw, well, what's your best case? Because in that moment, why can't a police officer shoot him? And where's, give me a case that I can hang my hat on.
Sure. So I think there's a series of cases, and it really goes back to the Garner rule, Judge. And the Garner, Tennessee versus Garner rule, this court has said, is clearly established even in situations with diverse factual distinctions.
Well, but Garner says that you can, which candidly, okay, you can shoot someone who's fleeing who poses a serious threat to physical injury. Someone who punches you in the face is different than someone who's fleeing, and they definitely poke. If they punch you in the face, as your friend said, you could fall backwards, you could get knocked out, the gun's there. I mean, it could pose a threat of serious physical injury. I don't think there's a case that says a police officer can't shoot someone who punches them.
Well,
that's what I'm looking for, is something like that.
Right. Well, Judge, as the lower court found, there's a question of fact as to whether the officer had probable cause to believe there was a serious imminent threat under these circumstances.
Not in the antecedent. You may be right in the antecedent portion of this. I don't disagree with that. Before we get to this point, what the officer did, I don't disagree, that may or may not be very problematic. Okay? But in the moment that he shot, which is the moment we look at, he gets spit on, told you're going to have to kill me, and punched in the face. We all agree on that. So the question is, what fact, what case clearly establishes that he can't shoot him in that moment? I'm not disagreeing with you. Anything that happened
right
before that.
Right. No, I understand. And one of the reasons there's a dearth of case law on this issue is because officers are on notice that they cannot generally shoot unarmed individuals.
But a dearth of case law that cuts against you. In other words, you've got to point to a case that clearly establishes this. You understand what I'm saying?
I do, Judge. I do, but I also can point to a series of cases that recognize that you do not need the exact identical facts on all four. What is clearly established, and one of the cases relied upon by the defendants in this case, is Mitchell v. Schlebaugh. And Mitchell v. Schlebaugh says that the majority says that the dissent correctly notes, it is settled law that an unarmed suspect has a right not to be shot dead when he doesn't pose the requisite threat.
But in that case, he hadn't punched the officer in the face. I mean, that's a different, the fact situation's different. It's kind of like some of the cases you point to where a guy's got a sidearm at his side and does nothing. I agree with you. I mean, we have cases saying you can't shoot an armed person that poses no threat. But we have said you can, the officers can use deadly force when there's a threat of serious injury.
Right, and there's a question as to whether there is a threat of serious injury in this case. As the lower court found, not all punches are the same, Judge, respectfully. But we have to look at the context of the circumstances. And when you look at this fight, when you look at it, and the facts from earlier, the earlier fights, no one was injured. Tommy Yatsko is outweighed by 100 pounds by this well-trained officer who is trained in hand-to-hand combat.
How does an officer factor that in? Because there's plenty of, I mean, boxers, you know, wrestlers, amateur boxers that are way less than the officer. It's, right? What the officer knows at the time is he was fighting earlier, he's fighting now, he punched him in the face.
these two mutual combatants during this fight, during this altercation, does it rise to the level of serious physical harm that warrants a proportional use of responsive force being deadly force? And I think this court runs the risk of announcing a very dangerous rule in this case.
So if an officer on the street has a gun out and someone walks up to him and punches him in the face, the officer cannot use the weapon. That's the rule you want, right?
Those facts are different from this case, I would argue, Judge.
Dean
Grazioli had
here. Let me walk you a step back. Officer shows up at a bar. Here, someone's been fighting inside. They come out. Officer gets his gun out, says, "Get off the premises." And instead, the person approaches and punches him in the face. Officer shoot him or no?
No. No, absolutely not. And I think one of the reasons you don't have a lot of cases that have these specific facts is because officers encounter people who swing their fists or resist all the time, all day, every day.
And should courts be encouraging that? I mean, you're asking us to say officers can't use the weapons at their disposal to stop people from disobeying. Doesn't that create anarchy at some point? I mean, the flip side, I get your point's valid, but I mean, there's two sides to this.
I understand. Officers should use their training, other less than lethal options, than going right to resorting to a gun and literally bringing a gun to a fist fight that the officer started, I would add, in this case. And this officer, as the court knows, violated policies by not carrying any less than lethal options. He didn't retreat. He was able to fend Tommy off with one arm. He had a number of other options available to him that were much more reasonable. And these punches, he never fell down. He never lost consciousness. Immediately after he shoots Tommy, he's seen walking around, communicating with people. He was not being pummeled to the point where his life was in danger, where he was at risk of serious bodily injury or harm. And so, yes, I think that all officers are on notice that when a suspect resists, including even throwing a punch or an elbow or a knee, that is hand-to-hand combat, and there are restraint techniques that officers employ every day. But immediately resorting to shooting someone while you are in a mutual combat situation, again, one he started, that is excessive force. Officers are on notice of that. Some cases that we cited in our brief, and I have one that we did not for your honors to consider, but we cited Sample versus Bailey that talks about this concept that the facts don't need to be identical, that officers are on notice, that you can't use lethal force in response to non-lethal
threat. That's what the Ohio criminal law is, that they can only use deadly force if there's an imminent threat of,
yes, sir,
of death to you or serious bodily injury. Otherwise, it's actually a violation of criminal law in Ohio.
Yes, sir.
And that would apply to the officer as well.
Yes, sir. That's
so he would have been prosecuted if it's not imminent that he's threatened with death or serious bodily injury. And I guess your argument is there's issues of fact as to that, particularly the imminent part of it.
Absolutely.
He's been punched in the face once. Is it imminent that he's going to be punched again with serious bodily injury or threat of death? I understand that.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That is exactly right. That is our position in this case, and that's the proportionality component that this court has often discussed. And this was an exceedingly disproportionate response under the totality of the circumstances.
We also recognize our jurisdiction interlocutory appeal of qualified immunity is very limited, and we don't get into factual.
Exactly. And we have included in our papers before the court that Sergeant Grazioli's appeal should be dismissed on jurisdictional grounds because he does still refuse to concede the facts.
And we've done that before where they don't concede the facts.
Correct.
Plan.
Yeah, so we've made that argument. That's to the court's discretion. I am here to argue the merits while I'm before you. And so when it comes to the clearly established prong, we think that was waived at the court below because Sergeant Grazioli argued a 14th Amendment standard claiming there was no seizure and never argued clearly established. To the extent this court would take up the clearly established prong and not dismiss the appellant's appeal for lack of jurisdiction, we've cited cases like Sample versus Bailey,
Can I move you back? What's the effect of him not arguing clearly established below? I saw that in the district court's opinion.
Forfeiture and waiver, Your Honor.
So can he contest it on appeal in the first instance, I guess, is my question. In a QI appeal? I don't know the answer.
No, we argued in our papers, no, that he cannot, that there's no jurisdiction over an argument that was not raised at the lower court level. It was not preserved in his motion for summary judgment. It was perfunctory at best, and the court can choose not to take it up. If the court does take it up, we've identified cases and the...
Am I right that the district court said it wasn't deciding because it wasn't presented to it?
No, the district court said that it was, while non-traditional briefing or something to that effect, that a defense of qualified immunity was ultimately asserted at the court below. But the court said because there are questions of fact as to whether or not there was an imminent risk of the kind of threat that would warrant, that would even permit under the law, a use of deadly force, the court in its footnote said it doesn't get to the clearly established prong, Judge, and that's Judge Stafford, that's what you and I were just discussing, that these, in this particular case, where the most critical Graham factor is the threat that's posed, officers are on constitutional notice that they cannot shoot someone dead who doesn't pose that threat. And so that underlying factual issue has to be interpreted in our favor at this point. And there are factual issues as to whether or not under these circumstances, this fight and these punches rise to that level. If they don't, it's clearly established that you cannot shoot someone dead.
All right, before you run out of time, can you also address the null issue?
Sure, thank you, Judge. In my minute that I have left, I do disagree slightly with my colleague as to the evidence that we put forth. The DOJ report itself is competent evidence of customs and practices.
Okay, just assuming it is, it's a stale report, is it not? I mean, it's years ago.
It goes up through 2014, and this did occur in 2018, but I would say it's relevant, Judge, in that when we look at the history of Sergeant Grazioli, who has a history of getting into fights at bars, who has a history of not reporting uses of force, and has a history of lying on duty reports, that evidence that over the course of time, this officer was engaged in the very same kind of conduct that is referenced in the DOJ report, it's relevant and admissible. I would also add our Monell claim is also...
Does that establish, even if it's relevant and admissible, you have to establish under Monell a custom practice of the city of allowing this and sanctioning it. And where do you do that? How do you allegedly do that?
Well, the DOJ report does include some of that, but we also have a specific evidence of that with respect to Sergeant Grazioli. His wrongful conduct that I just reiterated for the court was never, it was sanctioned. He was never appropriately held to account for that. I would finally add the last thing, Judge, and I know I'm running out of time, but the last thing is this idea that a city has no duty to supervise its officers to whom it issues city-issued firearms and puts them in their police uniforms to go out and work secondary employment, I think it's obvious they have a duty. They tell these officers they have to follow police rules and procedures. Sergeant Grazioli followed none of them during this secondary employment.
Okay, he did not follow them. And that kind of goes against the Monell theory that the city wanted him to follow procedures and he did not follow procedures. And I don't see how that helps you with Monell.
They're not monitoring it at all, Judge. In fact, they're claiming they don't have any duty to monitor anything these officers do on secondary employment. So an officer like Sergeant Grazioli knows he will never be held to account for any of his actions while he is working secondary employment. And there is case law.
Do you have evidence of that, or you just speculated that as a matter of practice, custom, they never supervise the officer?
We asked the safety director under oath in his deposition, it's in our papers, we asked him, why doesn't the city supervise these officers? And his answer was literally, his answer was, I don't have an answer for you.
Can I ask a question about the jurisdiction to address this issue?
Please.
There's arguments on both sides. You've been engaging in them. We would use appellate. said, first thing we have to look at is whether the cases are related, and here they're closely related. Well, that's a misunderstanding of Rule 54. The first factor is to see whether they're related, because if they are related, then we don't grant Rule 54 certification. He says they are related, and I am going to grant it. That's backwards, isn't it?
I don't disagree with the tenet that you announced, Judge. We believe that the cases are inextricably intertwined in certain respects, and that...
That just sort of on its face means it's not Rule 54. Certifiable. And that's the only basis. You didn't have a pending jurisdiction argument. Is that correct?
Correct.
So you're sort of conceding that maybe the district court did abuse its discretion in granting that certification?
I don't think it's an abuse of discretion, but I'm not going to take additional time to argue that about what we have. The last thing I would say.
I'll give you a minute. Can I give you a minute?
Sure.
I'll give you a minute or two to argue it. You won't be wasting anything.
Judge, I'd rather take my minute to raise one last issue.
I take that as you're really not defending it.
I'm happy to rest on our papers on the certification issue. I do want to address, finally, Your Honors, the issue as to the state law immunity ruling. We think the lower court's ruling is inherently contradictory, particularly to the intervening precedent of Stewart v. City of Euclid, 970F3-667, and that is that an Ohio recklessness claim as an exception to state law immunity generally rises and falls with the Fourth Amendment excessive force reasonableness analysis. We couldn't find a case where the Fourth Amendment reasonableness analysis goes to the jury and the recklessness analysis under Ohio law does not. Furthermore, the definition of the recklessness inquiry is whether a police officer reasonably had probable cause to believe he was at imminent risk of serious physical harm when fired upon. That's the Sixth Circuit citing Hayes versus Columbus, an Ohio appellate court case. The recklessness question, as this court has recognized, is generally a jury question. So here we have the lower court saying a jury could find no probable cause to believe the officer was at imminent risk of serious physical harm when fired upon. And that is the test for recklessness under Ohio law, but the court also said there is no jury question as to whether there was reckless conduct here. We would ask the court to correct that inherent contradiction in the court's ruling and allow trial to proceed on a recklessness theory under Ohio law as an exception to statutory immunity. It should rise and fall with the reasonableness analysis.
All right, very well.
Thank you.
All right. Counsel for Renzalo, let's get 2 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you again. David Linehan on behalf of Sergeant Grazioli. Listening to plaintiff's counsel, you'd believe that anytime an unarmed person is shot, that it's an issue of fact for the jury. But I think there's more here on the uncontroverted facts as the trial court found and as everyone agrees. When you have a person that is threatening you, that is not stopping, that says, I'm not going to stop until you kill me, it doesn't necessarily then become an issue of the jury to figure out if that person, in order to stop that, can use that kind of force.
What about his point that it's unclear if it would pose serious bodily injury, and so that's a question of fact, and you are contesting facts, which we don't have jurisdiction to resolve?
The only fact that I'm contesting is Jamila Chambers, who's the only person who claims he threw the first punch. That is a visual fiction if you look at her testimony and the video. She says she sees four punches.
What about his point about whether this could amount to serious bodily injury?
I, for,
seconds, which is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Almost an instantaneous point in time. There's the spit, the quote, the punch, the shot. Right? All of that takes place in a few seconds, right?
20 seconds, yes.
Oh. Yeah, 20 seconds is a lot more than a few.
The last,
I thought it was
the last
5 seconds or 3 seconds.
Yeah. No,
you're talking about a whole full 20 seconds.
As the trial court,
he's punched 5 times in the face.
They start with the jacket outside on here, and it comes back in the frame, and he's hit 5 times. Yes.
And you can see him hit him in the face.
Well, his back is to him, and you're seeing this.
Oh, I didn't see one of the back.
That's not what I looked at.
Yeah.
Then
what video is that?
It's definitely Exhibit E that the court asked us to resubmit because there was a problem.
Did you look at it? It's already resubmitted it.
Yes. But you'll actually see, like, it's the outside door. You'll see you'll see Grazioli leave, go outside.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and he comes back in the frame in that patio area. You see the entire, you see the shot. You see him shoot the guy. You see him fall on the ground. All that's on the
table. Yeah, I saw him shoot him